tend to think about sensor networks somewhat differently from the standard community, because our network nodes tend to actually be platforms. And in fact, my real interest is in the robotic element of that as a whole. But all of these platforms here, whether they're aircraft, underwater vehicles, ground vehicles, or whatever, carry a whole bunch of sensors. And a lot of the big problems that we're interested in looking at are how we build up big pictures of the environment using all these different sensors, and ideally how we use that information to control what these platforms are actually doing. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a brief background on, I suspect half of you here already heard about the sort of decentralized data fusion work that we do, but just a brief summary to show you that it's really, it's not magic, it's just a manipulation of Bayes' theorem. And then I'm going to move on and talk about two projects we've been working on the last couple of years. One is focused on fusion, which is basically trying to extend the paradigm using full Bayesian methods and integrating information from air-ground systems, but also from people and other sort of non-traditional information sources, as if they were components in the sensor network. And I'll talk a lot about the challenges that are involved in that, particularly how you learn feature models and how you try and learn big, large-scale density functions, probability density functions. And then I'm going to move on and talk about the control issue that was alluded to yesterday in John Fisher's talk, which is really how you go about using that information to decide what you're going to do with the platforms. And again, particularly with a project that involves a number of UAVs, how you actually coordinate them in an information-gathering type of task to actually gather the observations you need to make useful decisions. And finally, I'm going to talk about what I think are our next couple of years' challenges in terms of both the theory and the applications for this type of system. So the DDF paradigm differs significantly from the traditional distributed network type of problem in the sense that what you've got is an ad hoc network of sensors, but there's no central sink. There's no single place where you fuse information. On the contrary, every sensor has its own fusion center, and essentially what happens in these things here is that the sensor receives information from other fusion sites, not sensors, puts that information together locally here, fuses it, and sends the fused result to the rest of the network. So this guy here never talks to this guy here. The only way this guy up here gets this guy's information is because it's already been fused by a node that sits in between. And that has a particular advantage in the sense that it allows the system to scale very, very well. It makes it modular in a lot of interesting ways. And it also allows any node, any central point, doesn't matter, there is no central point in this network to fail without the network itself failing at any point. So we're not really gathering information because we actually need this information at the types of nodes I showed you to come up with reasonable decisions. So we need that local fusion paradigm. And over the last 20 years or more now, we've developed a lot of algorithms that operate on these networks for tracking, for navigation, for cooperative control, and various other flavors of types of things. So I wanted to kind of show you that there's no magic involved here, that indeed what John put up yesterday is really the answer, which is that we're interested in finding posteriors. That's really all data fusion is actually about at the end of the day. So we're interested in finding this term up here, the posterior of some state that we're interested in, and the big problem is we don't know what the state is. Based on a bunch of observations, we've got some prior information, we've got some sensor likelihoods, that is, we take observations, and we generate, in effect, a likelihood function on the state. And perhaps an important point to point out here is that what happens in this process is all the sensors actually talk about an underlying state. You don't send observations to each other, you actually send a description or a function on the underlying state of interest. And that kind of makes everything very anonymous and modular. You no longer have a sensor that's a temperature sensor or whatever, it's just something that contributes to the underlying state. And it makes a very nice modular feel to the whole thing. And it's not hard to take the equation like that and come up with any kind of architecture you like. I mean, all you're doing is rearranging the equation in some simple way. So here is a kind of hierarchical sort of system where you can imagine the likelihood sitting inside the sensors, and instead of sending out the observations now, you send out these likelihood functions on X. Of course, there are downsides. Likelihood function on X is bigger than the observation, but on the other hand, it does have an advantage in terms of making it modular, making it indistinguishable from other sensors, being able to do clever things and so on. And you can do a number of other different architectures. So here's another one where we actually take the posterior, send it back down to the sensors. Then the local sensors themselves have a posterior, perhaps to make local decisions. When they send it back up, you've just got to take care of the fact that, of course, you've all got some common information now, so you've got to get rid of it. Okay? So you've got to avoid all this double counting. Providing you stick with the underlying Bayesian principle, you can come up with all varieties of different architectures. And DDF is no different from any of those. DDF simply says, we'll take the fusion center and we'll put it in the node, okay? And then we'll just talk about posteriors to each other. And in effect, that's what DDF does. rather than communicating likelihood functions, it communicates posteriors to each other. And it just takes care of the fact that you need to avoid double counting and so on and so forth. So no magic, it's just Bayes' theorem rewritten in a different form, that's all. The other thing that's perhaps important saying is it's quite insightful to actually think of not Bayes' theorem per se, but the log of Bayes' theorem. Why? Because it turns out that it's highly related to all the information measures you want to use for control, deciding how you're going to communicate and so on. And also, it's additive by construction. All right. And if it's additive, it means you can do lots of things locally and guarantee that it's going to work globally. All right. And that really makes a big difference to the way you can distribute algorithms and so on. In fact, providing you stick with linearly additive payoff functions, there's a lot you can do that you can't do in general. And so from that, you can get a lot of useful measures, and we're going to talk about a few of them in this. The fact that you can actually measure the compactness of the density, that is how much information you've actually got there, and furthermore, a priori, try and get an indication of what contribution a new observation is actually going to make. Again, very much as John said in his talk, and we'll see applications of this as we go through. Perhaps the last thing that's worth saying is we've spent many years, a decade or more, actually working with a particular version of this in which you assume everything's Gaussian. If everything's Gaussian in this case, then it turns out to be a nice, simple algebraic form to all these equations known as either the Fisher canonical or information filters, in which instead of talking about state estimates X and covariances P, you actually talk about information vectors, information matrices, little y and big Y. You also convert the observations. But the big advantage of that is that it maps very simply into this equation up here, so that all the observation updates you need to do turn out to just be additions, okay, just vector additions, matrices additions, and so on, and you're guaranteed to end up with the globally optimal solution. Of course, there's a price to pay, and the price to pay is, of course, this is dual to the conventional Kalman filter equations, in the sense that what used to be the update equations, the complexity now appears in the prediction equations. And in fact, they're exactly dual, you'll see very similar terms and so on and so forth. But of course, in multi-sensor data fusion problems, the prediction's simple. It's all the data that's the problem. All right, so you've simply converted it into a form that makes the data fusion component much simpler. So where does it sit in this operation? Perhaps a few important things that are worth saying is, turns out that what these networks communicate to each other is information properly. All right, logs of posterior probability distributions and so on. And the nodes fuse local observations, which are in an information form, and all the information that's communicated through the network. And the last thing to say is that in order to avoid a lot of double counting, what you actually communicate is, in fact, not the total information in the network, but the information change, or the information gain, or more precisely, the mutual information in this case. So it turns out that what all the nodes communicate to each other are precisely information gain measures. And you propagate those through the network, all the deltas, and everybody adds up, and it all sort of flies at the end of the day. So that's the kind of background, and I think this is sort of stuff that we've been working on for rather long time now, and one of our objectives was to try and move away from this underlying Gaussian assumption and see whether it could be applied in more general situations. And in particular, we focused a lot on this project here called Answer 2. Answer 1 was essentially the Gaussian version of this, if you want. And Answer 2 really tried to take a lot of different platforms with different types of sensors to apply a full Bayesian model in this case, so to replace all those Y terms with four P terms and try and model that sort of information and look at features that come from these different domains, model general features like trees, dams, roadways, whatever else it may be that's interested in this case, identify and label these features and actually try and do inference in these large networks. Now, the changes you actually got to make, at least at the structural level, turn out to be relatively small. So the node itself actually looks very, very similar to exactly what we had before, except that instead of Y's now, you've just got posterior probabilities or likelihoods, that sort of thing, but you nevertheless go around the same fusion loop. And you, in fact, communicate, in this case, ratios of probabilities or differences in logs of probabilities. That's the mutual information between them. The real problem turns out to be this sort of element up here, which is how you take information that comes in as measurements, how you convert that into some kind of density function at the end of the day, that is, some probabilistic model of what it is you're actually looking at, so that when you end up with a likelihood function that these sorts of systems can actually use. Once you've got a likelihood function for the way that the observations go, then you're really just back to using Bayes' theorem again. Okay? And the density function problem is stronger in some sense than that, because you actually need some sensible density model that you're actually going to communicate over a network. And right at the very start, we precluded the use of our particle filter models, because the prospect of communicating multidimensional particles around a network really has no future, in my view. And so we try to look very hard, and I'll come back to this at the end, at other types of model we might actually use for communicating density functions in networks. So this is the kind of process we went through, and I'll talk a little bit about some of the key components of this project rather than the whole thing. As you'll see, it's quite a large program. In terms of actually taking input data from images or radars, or these are the typical kinds of sensors we have in our network, IR cameras and so on, trying to come up with interesting low-dimensional feature descriptions of what's going on in those images, and then from that, actually using an EM algorithm to come up with a likelihood function for what's an interesting feature and how that observation relates to the underlying state space. So in some sense, and I'll come back again to this at the end, it's what John talked about, it's what's X? That's really what's going on here, okay? So that's an important thing. Once you've got that, then there's an inference process where you take this model, you take images or observations. If you've got the likelihood model, then all you need to do is to take these observations, shove them in the likelihood model, and you come out with a state estimate for what's going on. So the model generation is quite hard. The inference process turns out to be relatively simple. So this is effectively how we went about trying to solve it. We use certain nonlinear dimensionality reduction techniques, in this case ISOMAP, to take things like raw images like this, find low-dimensional representations for things we're interested in, which turn out to be things like trees, and getting a parametric model of a tree in general, whether it's a gum tree or whether it's a palm tree or whatever, is quite a tricky thing to do, particularly as it varies across lighting conditions, whether you see it from the air, whether you see it from the ground, lots of different elements like that. And then we actually use a relatively new technique called variational Bayes expectation maximization to actually figure out a mixture model which actually describes what those low dimensional states mean, all right, in a probabilistic structure. So this VBM technique is quite useful because, as I'll show you on this bit here, it can actually take a nonlinear manifold, which is the typical kind of feature representation that you end up with, and actually simultaneously come up with the centers and the means and the variances and the number of mixture models that you actually want, which is a pretty difficult problem in general to do. And the other reason why it's very useful is it works in very high dimensions. So most of the observation dimensions we've got here are anything up to 100,000 dimensional. And so to actually be able to come up with density estimates in that kind of dimensionality space is a very tricky thing. And these VBM techniques, what's interesting about them is they all come up from, they were all invented for basically data mining on the web. All right, so that's essentially a data fusion tool. So what you do when you get that in the end is you end up with a location likelihood, which is essentially a mixture model. And as I said, it's modeled essentially as a sum of Gaussians in this case. So that's our underlying probability distribution that we're using. Now, why is that a good one? Well, it's a good one because when you take products and you try and do convolution with sums of Gaussians, you just end up with sums of Gaussians. So it's closed in that sense. Why is it not a good distribution? Because if you take products of sums of Gaussians, if you have m Gaussians and n Gaussians, you get m times n Gaussians at the end, and you essentially have to do resampling. And there's a non-uniqueness in here because it's not an orthogonal expression for whatever function you're looking at, and so the resampling problem is very tricky. So it's not ideal, but it is good in at least in some circumstances, or at least in the fusion process. And likewise, also getting the likelihood associated with the labels. So here is a particular subspace that we're looking at, and here we've got color and various texture information, and we're able to identify things like tree trunks, tree tops, grass, white cars, various other things that appear in this sort of thing, in essentially a semi-supervised manner. And the inference process is then fairly straightforward. You've now got the likelihood model, and all you need to now do is to take observations in. So this is this image plane, and here you can see we're labeling in real time, not just where the location of things are, but also what they are, trees, different types of features, and in specific cases, even what the number of the tree is, that is the specific tree that we've seen before from another sensor or another domain. So here you can see 21, tree 1, and so on. So this is the basic inference process. Inference process is real time, okay, but the model generation is not real time at all. And likewise, you can do the same thing from the ground. So for us, it's important to be able to recognize the fact that when you see a tree from the air, you can also see it from the ground. Whether you see it in a radar image or you see it in an IR image, you've got to be able to associate that information across the different sensors. And again, it's really an issue in terms of generating this common underlying state space from the likelihood function. So this is the raw information that's going to each of the sensor nodes. We also did quite a bit of work actually trying to integrate people into this and to other databases and so on. And I'll come back to this in a minute, but basically we treat people as sensors in the same way that you would any other sensor in the network. They're able to generate label information, they're able to provide context information, they're also able to provide metric information on ranges and bearings and things like that. And they input this information via a GUI, and likewise they receive the same fused information back that any other node in the network would have. And we've applied the same sort of thing to using databases, because in this case we also have hyperspectral databases of the terrain that we're interested in, and you can again do identification, labeling, metric information, and so on, and extract those from the databases. So the idea here is to really kind of generalize the idea that all of these are just information sources, all right? There's no difference between that and any other sensor within the network. And picking up on what was mentioned yesterday about middleware, we've developed quite a sophisticated middleware to support this operation. So these are the standard components, and perhaps the most important feature, this is called Orca, it's available on SourceForge if anyone's interested, is that actually it talks and it does all its modeling in terms of things like likelihoods and posteriors and so on. So you actually specify a likelihood for a sensor, you talk about posteriors and other calculational nodes, you assemble them together and then you can graphically lay them out, and we can reprogram this entire system in under an hour, and it's quite a sophisticated system. So again, we're trying to exploit the fact that you get modularity, very standard interfaces using likelihoods and posteriors that you can use in this domain. So the system video, it's rather long, so I'm going to take it offline and so I can skip through parts of it. If Bill Gates lets me run it. No. Okay, just give me a... Okay. For some reason it never works the first time around. So the system, this is basically, we operate our own flight test facility, about 20,000 acres, where we've got living accommodation, runways, things like that, but otherwise it's traditionally Australian looking. Perhaps not enough sun. This gives you a better idea from the air. It's fairly vegetated. Let's come up to the nodes. So we've got a variety of different sensor nodes. We've got there is a sensor node that's used in this experiment sitting on top. So there's a camera and an IR system and a GPS. We've got them on unmanned vehicles. We've got them on manned vehicles. It gives you a bit of a close-up for that one. And we have it on an aircraft as well. So we have it's a side-looking IR system on this thing. And it also has a downward-looking millimetric band radar. Here's a human node, and he has various things that he can find range and bearing and do labeling information. There's the female equivalent node. But you don't notice the difference because they're just likelihood functions. Do they have the same likelihood function is the question that you need to answer. This is typical sort of operation. So you get a sense as to what's going on. This is simply a waypoint control. I'll come back to the control in a minute. And typical kinds of data. And then we have various different features we're interested in, like trees, dams, roadways, but also man-made features like cars, red cars versus white cars versus tanks of different descriptions and so on, water tanks, I mean, and so on. So that gives you a flavor for what the system looks like. And now what I'd like to show you is the data that appears at every node. And again, for some reason, this video needs two attempts to start. I have no idea why. So the point that you should get at this point is that every node in the network ends up with exactly the same estimates as every other node in the network. So what you're seeing here is what the operator sees, but you'd see exactly the same pieces of information in the aircraft or on the ground vehicle or any other sensor node. And then the other thing you should look at, so this is just a section where you can see the aircraft going around, the ground vehicle and the person here, is the types of information. In particular, you can see, for example, there's just been a single bearing measurement on this particular feature here. All right, so it's a general distribution, and it's been identified as a white object, but otherwise there's no other information. Some objects have been identified in here, you'll see, but are unknown types. That is, they haven't got any label information at the moment, and it actually requires some other sensor or person to go in there and actually label what's going on. Other ones have got very specific information. So there's a red car there, there's a red car there, there's a specific tree there, and so on and so forth. So there's different pieces of information that are coming into the network, and as the system rotates around, you'll see there's one observation, so it takes a while for this to propagate through the network. As the vehicle's seen it, it's got one bearing information on this object here. Wait for it to appear there, okay? And it still requires, in this case, the ground vehicle to come around and take another identification to figure out what's going on. So these are four bays, ID and location information in a fully distributed manner from these different types of platforms. So what were the challenges, or what are the challenges? And again, I'm going to pick up on what John said. It's really an issue of finding out what X is, finding out what P is, and finding out what Z is. And the X part of this is really all about finding these feature models. And we've made a good start at that. There are still some interesting things that are unknown. That is, when we come back 2 weeks from when we first did it and all the lighting's changed and the leaves have fallen off the trees, can we still recognize a tree? All right. And so there are big issues about how you generalize single feature models in these general types of modes. The other thing which I find particularly interesting is how you end up with mixed models, how you learn mixed models of things. So if I'm looking at a tree with a radar and a camera, what is it that these two things have in common? Okay, what is it that characterizes a tree in those two different sensor domains? And there's a real issue here trying to figure out what these models are and to refine and abstract them, and I think mutual information is the right solution to that problem. So finding X is a big issue. Finding P is a big problem. Doing very high dimensional density estimation is probably the biggest stumbling block in doing this type of data fusion. And we need much better techniques for being able to tackle that problem. And I'll come to a specific issue here, which is finding a general and efficient density family closed under all these fusion operations. We've used mixture models here, but there must be better other families that we can use that are efficient in terms of how you communicate them around the network, and which actually can model a lot of these things that we have. And we need to find answers to that, or we're never going to be able to do serious data fusion in networks. So the statisticians out there, take note. The other thing is finding Z. It turns out that information that's flying around the network turns out to be a very good way of actually designing whole systems. You saw those nodes in the middleware, they're actually outputting information measures. And it's not impossible to imagine a system now that says, I need this sort of information, therefore what combinations of all these components on the average would give me the right information? And could I use that for actually designing the network as a whole? That is, choosing what Zs I actually need for a particular task. So let me talk a little bit about control now. As I mentioned, mutual information turns out to be what comes out of these nodes. And we've done a lot of thinking and work on basically how we can actually use mutual information for control. I'm not going to say too much about it because, again, it came up in John's talk earlier. But suffice to say that because mutual information is what comes out of these nodes, simply if you exchange that information and you choose trajectories, in our case, so we have a slightly different scenario. Our sensors are in motion rather than being stationary, and typically the things we're interested in tracking are actually stationary. So it's a flipped around situation now, and the question you want to ask is, what trajectory should these aircraft or vehicles fly in order to maximize the amount of information they gain as a group? So if you look at these two here, the inner trajectories are trajectories where you don't exchange mutual information, and the outer trajectories are those where you do exchange mutual information. And if you do exchange mutual information, flip it around, the inner ones are where you do, the outer ones are where you don't, then you can clearly see you get a higher resolution much, much quicker because you're basically choosing those observations that maximize information gain. Now, what I wanted to show you was actually a flight demonstration of exactly that principle, all right, which actually shows how you can use the same sort of idea to control platforms in motion to gather the information you want. And this is a program that's been running for the last couple of years, and really the question is, I've got a bunch of UAVs, I've got a candidate list of things I'm interested in looking at. How would I schedule all those and get them to organize all their trajectories so that they actually find out the right information from that environment? So you want to locate, identify, and take a look at what goes on with all those targets and demonstrate this process. And again, it builds a little bit on what John talked about without perhaps some of the interesting theoretical results, in the sense that all we really got is a bunch of mutual informations associated with maneuvers for the aircraft, where they're orbiting targets, where they're following particular trajectories, and so on. And we've got two aircraft in this particular case, and they operate a DDF network, and what they've got to do is to jointly decide which vehicle should go to which target, across which trajectories, and how they queue and hand off their information as they fly. And in this case, we're using a K-step look ahead. So again, we're using a very similar process where we actually take a number of steps forward and we evaluate what we get over that receding horizon. Targets we're interested in are things, again, like trees, roadways, dams, that type of information. So it uses the same natural feature information as before. And this gives you an indication. This is a fairly scary experiment. So we have a guy take off the aircraft one after the other. But once they're in the air, a file gets downloaded of interesting things to go and look at. They then start negotiating with each other, and they actually compute all the trajectories online. Okay? So as you'll see, as this flies along, they get perilously close to each other because there's no collision avoidance algorithm in this particular thing. But don't worry, because they are separated in altitude by about 30 feet. So it just looks scarier than it is. So they each have an IR and a radar camera, millimetric band radar, and also an infrared system on board. So this just shows the operation. We'll show you in a second. Now, the interesting thing here is how all this coordination is actually closely coupled with communication. Because the way the aircraft work is they have a 802.11 transmitter underneath, all right? But as the aircraft bank, they go in and out of communication. So you can only talk when you can actually see each other. So in this case here, you can see when they're actually talking is when the red lights are on, okay? So they're in process at that point. They've got a number of candidate points they can look at the ground, and they have to figure out, it's a side-looking thing, because you need to orbit it to actually get location data, because it's a bearings-only device, all right, and to get ID information. And here, these are the mutual information. This is essentially a measure of the mutual information each of them has about the target. And it's only when they can communicate to each other that they can actually exchange task information and decide which of them should see which target. And sometimes they'll go look at the same target because they can't talk to each other. All right? So you get that kind of a effect happening. And again, as you'll see here, you can see they swap over very, very close to each other because those turn out to be optimal trajectories where you actually cross the bearings information across each other and so on. So this is it. This is really very close to an implementation of the sort of thing that you were talking about yesterday. So I think that's basically good enough. We've looked at extending the paradigm as well to things like queuing, handoff. It turns out information gain problems are also, they're very, very similar. You can apply them in search, exploration. They're all information gain problems. And we've got a number of different programs looking at developing algorithms for these sorts of things. So far only in simulation, but hopefully near-term in-flight demonstration mode. So future challenges in control. One of the big things we see is dealing with constraints. And it's not so much constraints for the platform is constraints for the ground. That is, you can't fly through the ground, you can't fly through certain airspaces, this type of thing. And the other big one is timing constraints, for particularly trying to get two platforms to rendezvous at a given point in time without specifying what that time is. Those are important constraints. And cooperative planning. So you've got two platforms, you've got to figure out who's best at doing which particular task given the constraints that they have and so on. So future challenges. I think there is a lot that has to be done in the theory area, but it still boils down to PX and Z. There's no question about that. But PX and Z in many different things, things like spatial scale, whether you're dealing at the millimeter level or at the kilometer level, temporal scales, whether you're dealing over the next few milliseconds or maybe over the next 10 years. They're all basically integrated in this. And I envisage to myself this autonomous sensor where, you know, I don't tell it anything. I just put it down or put it on an aircraft, and it starts flying, it starts chatting to its neighbors, and it starts off by sending raw information, eventually figures out what they've got in common, particularly using mutual information, and eventually abstracts a language which they can actually start exchanging information and build themselves into the network. And I think the statistical problems in that are really, really tremendously interesting. And we've got two great applications we're currently working on, and I'll say a little bit about them. One of them is mine picture compilation. Mining companies are making vast amounts of money at the moment, and there's a real issue for them to basically get a real-time picture of what's going on in a huge mine area and be able to operate that mine remotely if it's autonomous. And you want to integrate data from satellites, airborne systems, geophysical drilling, through-ground systems and so on, airborne laser, from face radar, building up pictures. So you get this whole thing from the millisecond where you're digging to the 10-year plan of the mining horizon, okay, at different scales and everything else. And it's a very exciting project. The other one, a little smaller scale than the American one, is a program to autonomously monitor the barrier reef. There's been a huge investment through NCRIS in these effect equivalent of ocean observatory sorts of things, where we've got a number of gliders, underwater autonomous vehicles, fixed beacons and so on, and to monitor not really just what's going on in the reef at any given time, but to monitor change, whether it's over a small time frame, or whether it's years or decades even and so on. And again, there are a lot of challenges here, particularly because the sensing is, there's far fewer possibilities for doing sensing underwater. You're really limited to acoustic and various laser types of things and so on and so forth. So I'll stop there.